In our new series, World War II's Greatest Battles, we chart five pivotal moments that shaped the course of the conflict with military historian James Holland. New episodes drop every Thursday on the History Extra podcast.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Welcome to the History Extra podcast. Fascinating historical conversations from the makers of BBC History Magazine. When it comes to the tumultuous timeline of the Soviet Union, the 1960s has often been overlooked. But, argues Robert Hornsby in today's episode, this was in fact a pivotal era that deserves greater attention. As he explains to Danny Bird, from the launch of Sputnik and Yuri Gagarin's pioneering orbit to greater opportunities for women and young people in the USSR, the Soviet 60s was a time of optimism. An optimism that came to an abrupt end in 1968.
Thank you for joining me to discuss your new book, The Soviet 60s. Now, despite its title, you have decided to look beyond the conventional framing of a decade and treat the 60s very much as a standalone era. What is significant about this period in Soviet history, and why does it deserve greater attention?
Well, principally, the book does cover the span from 45 through to 68, but primarily it's about 53 to 68. So I used the late Stalin period, the post-war Stalin period, to sort of tee up lots of the themes that come out. So this is a time of very extensive repression, xenophobia and isolationism. And I kind of use the first chapter to set that period against what comes next. There are big changes in foreign policy, in cultural policy. Millions of people are released from the labour camps and places of exile. So it kind of works really well to set up what comes next by starting with this sort of post-war period in that sense. So I use the 60s as an era rather than a decade starting, you know, in January 1960 and ending in December 69. And we see this in all kinds of fields now. So in the US, for example, there's lots of talk about what is the American 60s era, whether it begins, for example, with the election of Kennedy, or whether it ends with different forms of escalation in Vietnam. So there's a sense of thinking of the 60s as an era rather than a decade. And my take on this for the Soviet Union is that the 60s begins with this sort of new burst of vibrancy and reform that we see really beginning quite soon after Stalin dies. The first prisoners, for example, are released the same month that Stalin dies. This is how immediate the effects are in that sense. And I tend to see 68 as being a kind of an end point in which even potential hopes of a more liberal kind of Soviet regime, and I use liberal in a very relative sense in that context, that 68 is kind of the death of these hopes when the Soviet Union invades Czechoslovakia, takes a very decisive turn against, essentially against reform of all kinds. The regime again becomes much more conservative in pretty much all spheres of activity. And so I see this sort of window of 15 years in which by no means is sort of liberalisation solidly the order of the day throughout, but which there are kind of important flashes and flickers and events which at least present the possibility of a very different kind of Soviet Union. And in actuality, it is a different kind of country that emerges, although not so different as it seems might be happening at different points. But what we see emerging is a country which, for example, repression does not disappear. I would not suggest anything of the sort, but it declines dramatically. People's living standards go up. there are all kinds of ways in which this is fundamentally a different country from Stalinism. There are continuities too, in all kinds of ways, but I would suggest that the change that we see in this period, and this continues afterwards under Brezhnev in lots of ways, that this kind of creates a different model of the Soviet system to some extent.
And I suppose if there's one individual that most people listening will associate with the changes you've mentioned, it's Nikita Khrushchev. Who was he and how did he come to have such an impact at this time?
Well, Nikita Khrushchev is one of the most fascinating characters, I would suggest, of modern history. He's a character who has really quite substantial credit for some of the things he did, as well as kind of, you know, very substantial negatives going on in his record. Firstly, under Stalin, when he was as knee-deep in blood as anybody else. In terms of who he was and how he comes to power, Khrushchev, at the time that Stalin dies, is absolutely in Stalin's inner circle of half a dozen, roughly, key figures. And he's not by any stretch the front runner to succeed Stalin. That seems quite clearly to be Georgi Malenkov. Khrushchev, however, like Stalin in the 20s, is perhaps you might say underestimated by his rivals for power. He's also a lot more cunning than people give him credit for. He's pretty ruthless in all kinds of ways, not necessarily in the sort of bloodthirsty Stalin way, but certainly he's someone who can change political positions pretty drastically when it suits him and when it, you know, sort of trips up his opponents. He sometimes plays the country bumpkin type figure, but there's a lot going on sort of under the hood, as it were, I think, with Khrushchev. He's very impulsive as a person. He's absolutely convinced of himself and of his own sort of correctness of the positions he takes, regardless of how misguided those positions are sometimes. He's not much fun to work with. Certainly, as the 60s start to progress, Khrushchev becomes, again, he doesn't sort of jail his colleagues like Stalin is prone to do, but certainly he, you could safely say that he bullies them. He would be a HR person's nightmare today as a boss. So he's continually kind of swearing and pounding the table when people don't sort of live up to what he wants. But, you know, he still also has a softer side to him as well. He's not an out-and-out monster by any stretch. But yeah, as the years in power sort of roll on, he becomes more and more difficult to work with, less and less inclined to listen to anybody else. And he has, you know, knowledgeable and skilled people around him. But when Khrushchev decides something is right, then that's all that she wrote, basically. He famously kind of, there's all these experts in, for example, foreign policy in the Soviet Ministry of Foreign Affairs, genuine experts. And when they put plans to Khrushchev about foreign relations and so on, there's this famous exchange where he says, well, if your plan says what I think, great. If it doesn't, then you can throw it in the bin. And this is a man with a handful of years of schooling. He struggles to write Russian grammatically. He's not stupid, but he has what we see in lots of the sources, and this is maybe an outdated and slightly prejudiced way of looking at him, but they talk about him having a kind of peasant cunning, the idea that while he's not educated in the sense of being well-read and being sort of, you know, particularly thoughtful as a man, I don't think anyone would accuse him of being particularly thoughtful, but certainly he has a fantastic memory. He has a way of kind of understanding how to deal with situations. So he's a tricky figure to weigh up in all those sorts of different ways.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging, so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway. And on it, there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy. So go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
And no doubt that cunning played a part in Khrushchev's secret speech at the Soviet Communist Party's 20th Congress. Do you think its revelations were fundamental to setting the scene for the decade that followed?
Well, the secret speech is important for a whole host of ways. The headline grabber has always been the denunciation of Stalin. And I'll come to that in a second. But that's not the only thing going on at the 20th Party Congress. So Congress is important, and you might think about this less important today, but if you think about the current political parties in this country, when they have their party conferences, as they call them now, they kind of set policy for the year ahead. They reflect on how brilliantly they've done over the past year. And Communist Party Congress is the same sort of deal in the Soviet Union, but they're much bigger in terms of the attention they draw in the media. It helps when you control the media, of course. And so they're reasonably historic events, certainly in the context of Soviet communism. And so they kind of set the new tone and the new discourse of what's coming. And the 20th Party Congress, again, this is before we come to Stalin, is important because in all kinds of ways, really. Certainly, Khrushchev talks at the Congress about peaceful coexistence with the US. This isn't the start of discourse about peaceful coexistence, but speaking about this at the Congress makes it official in lots of ways. This makes it kind of part of, you know, party doctrine. Beyond that, we see decisions on all manner of things. For example, talk about celebration of independence struggles against colonialism in Africa, Asia, Latin America. This is something that starts to feature extensively in Soviet policy and Soviet activity from this period onwards. We also see important changes around, for example, boring as this sounds, but like energy policy. This is when the Soviet leadership say, we're going to stop relying on coal and start exploiting more of what we know is in the ground in Siberia. And over the course of the next few years and then decades, that means oil and gas, especially. And this is absolutely crucial to the Soviet economy and now today to the Russian economy. So there are momentous decisions outside of the Stalin denunciation, but that is the one which completely understandably grabs people's attention. I guess the point to start with is that this is not a wholesale rejection of Stalinism by Khrushchev. It's much more an attack on the man. And even then, it's not a kind of a complete writing off of all that Stalin achieved. Again, I go back to the point that Khrushchev is not a particularly sophisticated thinker about these things. And actually, the secret speech, which is this crucial moment where Khrushchev, at the end of the Congress, kind of everybody's going home, they're checking out of hotels in Moscow, and then they're summoned back to the Kremlin. There's an extra session. Nobody, barring a handful of people, knew that this was coming, and they don't know what's about to be said. And Khrushchev stands there and basically gives a report of 4 hours plus where he's talking about the crimes of the Stalin period. 4 hours plus is not particularly extensive for Soviet regime speeches. That's generally sort of middle ground in terms of how long these speeches can go. But certainly there are people in the audience who know, you know, what has been going on under Stalin. But certainly the fact that this gets said at all is really striking. And he exposes Stalin's involvement in all sorts of groundless repression. He talks about Stalin's war leadership and goes on and on beyond Stalin's vanity and the Stalin cult and so on and so forth. And it's known as the secret speech because Khrushchev, at the very end, he tells everyone to, you know, keep this under your hat as if such a thing were possible. But then they decide fairly soon after that, if we're going to really overcome the damage that Stalin did, we need to tell normal Communist Party members, people who weren't at the Congress, and then also communist youth, and then maybe also a few other groups as well. And what that means is that, you know, fairly quickly, tens of millions of people have heard about this, and it proves explosive socially that people want to know, well, how was Stalin able to commit all these massive crimes? Why didn't you guys do anything about this? What does it mean about the revolution that we had in this country if it can turn so violent and bloodthirsty? And so there are millions of questions. What do we do now about Trotsky, for example? What do we do now about all these officials who were involved in Stalinist repressions? Because people were, you know, kind of out and proud Stalinists until, you know, March 1953, and now all that stuff is being exposed. For some people, this is the start of a promising era when we're finally going to deal with serious problems, one of them being, you know, Stalinist repression. And what we see there is that people somehow end up kind of divided between those who think Khrushchev isn't going far enough tackling Stalin. I would be in that camp, I think. And then we also see the other group of people, which are those who say Khrushchev has gone too far. We shouldn't be washing our dirty linen in public, as it were, that this all weakens the regime. The other people on the other side will say the way that you fix things is you find the problems, you expose them, you deal with them, and that's how we'll, you know, we'll move forward and we'll get back on track in terms of building communism. And then you have the basically a diametrically opposed view, which says we don't need to do all this in public. And so this sets up a division which lingers long in the Soviet system. Sometimes it bursts into life. Sometimes it's kind of dampened down. Certainly during the Brezhnev years, this stuff is largely silent. But it comes back to life under Gorbachev again in the 80s. So this is an important fault line that the 20th Congress opens up in that respect.
Now, one of the defining moments of this period was the space race between the USSR and America. What kind of impact did the launch of Sputnik have on the Soviet imagination?
I think it's fair to say that these were absolutely critical to the way in which people experienced the period and the way in which we ought to look back on the period as well. So, for reasons which are entirely understandable, the focus has often been on liberalisation and releasing people from the gulag. But I think the flavour of the age in many ways is sort of driven through things like the space race in particular, but there's a wider kind of cult of science going on. So Sputnik, this is a big win for the Soviet Union, I guess, is the first place. And this is, it's easy to miss the point, this is the start of the space age, which at least at the time is a big deal globally. And it wins the Soviet Union huge numbers of admirers abroad, people all over the world, whether in East or West Europe, North, South America, across Africa, people are absolutely entranced by Sputnik. I can't think of a modern day equivalent in terms of the leap forward that has been made by putting an artificial satellite into space. So this wins the Soviet Union huge amounts of credibility internationally, and it sort of drives a huge amount of enthusiasm at home as well. People are really kind of stunned and impressed. Less spoken about in terms of why Sputnik is important and all of the space race, really, is that Sputnik sits on top of the world's first intercontinental ballistic missile. What this means is that if the Soviet Union can put this satellite into space, then it also means they can hit the US with their nuclear warhead. So this is also very important as a kind of a military story. That's always understated. Soviet propaganda always talks about space as being a sort of a peaceful endeavour for the benefit of humanity and so on. But there is always this sort of undertone of military. And then obviously we have these great propaganda successes around the successive space dogs that go up, first Laika, and then less storied are the whole host of ants and fungi and other sorts of insects which go up into space as well with all the different space dogs and so on. But first Laika and then Belka and Strelka, the difference there, in case anyone doesn't know, Laika is basically on a one-way mission from the start. The Soviet authorities kind of pretend that Laika survives for a good while, but that's just not true. Belka and Strelka are interesting because they come back in one piece and they instantly become these sort of very cuddly, iconic figures, which are sort of, you know, a softer image for the Soviet regime in lots of ways. And, you know, this is one of those things that obviously kids fall in love with, but adults too. This is a big scientific achievement. It's not just a sort of a, you know, a cuddly display. And then you get Yuri Gagarin, for example, followed by multiple other cosmonauts. Then you get Valentina Tereshkova, the first woman in space. And there's a whole run from 57 with Sputnik through to the mid-60s where the Soviet Union is winning the space race. And the Americans are having not quite disaster after disaster, but they keep falling behind with, you know, things blowing up and missions being kind of underwhelming just after the Soviet side has been into space. I think one of the interesting things about this, and maybe this is tells us something about the age, is the sense to which there's a kind of a pioneering spirit about it. For the Soviet Union, this is all about, you know, the promise that we're building this utopian future. And actually going into space and winning these sorts of space duels, as it were, with the US in terms of first satellite, first person, and so on. This sort of suggests that maybe they are doing something special in the Soviet Union. Maybe actually they are making progress towards this sort of utopian future. But actually what we see in lots of cases, and I certainly don't mean to kind of demean the achievements that they make. There are brilliant scientists and very brave people involved. And brave is absolutely the key to a lot of this. It's worth saying a couple of missions do end up in tragedy. We see in 66, Vladimir Komarov, for example, plummets to Earth at a terrifying speed and there's virtually nothing left of him. We see an explosion which kills huge numbers of people at the test site in Kazakhstan. And there are lots of missions that could have gone a lot worse. The point about Yuri Gagarin before he sets off, he doesn't do a great deal of flying, it's worth saying. He's essentially someone to be in the capsule, but he doesn't actually fly anything. It's all automated. But the point really, I suppose, is that this is a hugely risky endeavour in the sense that they don't know what will happen if the capsule goes off trajectory, for example. If Gagarin lands at sea, they have no sense of how they're going to find him and collect him again. He's basically doomed. One of the first things they do is they draft a kind of a world press release asking people to help find a missing astronaut in case he goes off target and lands somewhere in who knows where. And actually, before Gagarin, they've always had a bomb on board the craft. So if it goes off-piste, as it were, they can blow it up before enemy countries find Soviet technology. And you know, as a gesture of humanity, they don't have a bomb on Gagarin's flight. This is obviously, you know, a fairly minor gesture in terms of kindness and humaneness, not blowing him up if he goes off course. But certainly, you know, Gagarin, as I mentioned in the book, he goes into space with a knife because, you know, there's every chance he's going to land somewhere. Even if he lands in the Soviet Union, he could be a long way from where he's supposed to be. And actually, he does land a long way from where he's supposed to be, sort of on a collective farm, not far from the River Volga. And we have this really great contrast of when he lands, he's just become the first man in space and the whole world knows about him. The Soviet regime announces his flight while he's still in the air, which is kind of risky because he could easily be killed on the way back down. He gets tangled up in the parachute, for example, and you know, the Soviet regime is chancing its arm quite substantially in announcing this before he's safely back on the ground. This, incidentally, is when his own wife finds out that he's the one who's gone into space, and his parents, and his dad is sort of taken off the collective farm where he lives and he's bundled into a horse and cart and he goes to the local town to kind of find out more. And Gagarin too, when he lands, he lands kind of in the middle of nowhere on a great big collective farm, and he ends up hitching a ride with a local peasant woman and her child to get back to the farm and then ring and say, "It's me, I've landed, I'm fine." So this is all a bit haphazard at times.
I'd like to turn next to the non-Russian republics of the Soviet Union, as it's easy to forget that the USSR was comprised of more than just Russia. Did the 1960s present new opportunities for the peoples living in them?
So this is another one of those areas where it feels useful to kind of set the post-Stalin period alongside the Stalin period, because certainly post-war Stalinism, there's a great deal of suspicion towards non-Russian peoples. Any hint of non-Russian nationalism, real or imagined, faces very vicious clampdown. For example, in Estonia, there's hugely extensive purging of the Communist Party there on supposed grounds of nationalism. After Stalin, things start to improve in various ways. And I should caveat this by saying the ability to kind of express national cultures and pride, this is non-Russian national cultures and pride, is always kind of quite tightly bounded. The regime will still come down hard, and they do in Latvia and Azerbaijan at the end of the 50s, if they feel that things are kind of slipping beyond acceptable in terms of expressing local culture rather than Soviet culture. But certainly things do improve. We see the different non-Russian republics, so whether this be Ukraine or Belarus or the Baltics, Latvia, Lithuania, Estonia, or over in Central Asia, so Turkmenistan, Tajikistan, etc. We see those places firstly gaining more in terms of infrastructure. The Stalin years especially have seen the bulk of spending and investment in Russia and especially in Moscow. Khrushchev distributes things a bit more fairly might be too strong a word, but certainly distributes things a bit more across the country in terms of building things like film studios and universities and teacher training and all this kind of thing. And we also see sort of new developments in terms of what you might think of as kind of markers of nationhood. Ukraine is a useful example here. This is one of the first points at which we see an official Soviet dictionary of the Ukrainian language, of which Ukrainian film studios, well, the Ukrainian film studio, is producing more and more films in the Ukrainian language rather than Russian, for example. And we see in Moscow a growing tolerance of, for example, festivals of whether it be Ukrainian dance or Estonian art. Everybody loves Georgian food in the Soviet Union. So we see a more sort of Soviet, and by that I mean non-Russian, a Soviet model of the Soviet Union emerge. But we also see, as the era progresses, a growing kind of Russian self-assertion as well. And the way to think about this might be to think about the position of England within Britain. So London is the British capital, and England is the biggest part of Britain, but obviously it's not the only part. And the Russian take on this is, well, we kind of have lost out in the Soviet Union too. The Russian Orthodox religion, for example, has been suppressed. Russian culture is somehow being turned into Soviet culture. And so we see this sort of growing assertion of Russian nationalism as the 60s sort of progress. And this, in some senses, is relatively benign and liberal-minded, but in other senses, it has sort of very authoritarian overtones, some of the kind of things we're seeing today in Russia, really. So this is a period in which sort of different nationalities of the Soviet Union both, in some senses, grow closer, but in some senses also start to move apart from each other.
And it seems that the Soviet Union's edifice was beginning to crack in other areas too, notably, I guess, in how cultural figures responded to the decade's tentative freedoms. Could you explain why the controversy around the publication of Dr. Zhivago arose?
So, the Pasternak affair is essentially when Boris Pasternak, who's already very famous as a poet, I should say, rather than a novelist, he writes his first novel, Dr. Zhivago, submits it for publication inside the Soviet Union, and he does this because one of the key sort of themes of the initial post-Stalin period especially is this idea of cultural thaw, this idea that the cultural scene is becoming more open, more pluralistic. It's still controlled pretty tightly by political authorities, but there is now more scope for what you might call loyal criticism of key problems. And this starts very early, 54. There's this famous essay on sincerity in literature, which kind of does what I mentioned earlier. It says, we need to expose our problems. We can't make the system better. We can't progress unless we actually tackle real problems and we stop hiding what's wrong. But all this kind of creates the atmosphere in which Pasternak thinks, maybe they'll publish my novel, Dr. Zhivago. This is not a sort of a strident anti-communist novel by any stretch. Essentially, the problem with Dr. Zhivago was that it wasn't sufficiently pro-communist. So its key characters, they're not at all communist heroes. They're very kind of individualistic. The civil war of the early 1920s is going on around them, and they're basically indifferent, when actually, you know, to be a good communist novel, they should be wholeheartedly backing the Reds and this sort of thing. So its problem kind of lies in its ambiguity. And actually, as it turns out, he submits his novel for publication and they say, well, I'm sorry, but no, we're not publishing this. And he sends it abroad. He sends it to Italy in the first instance. And then the whole situation sort of waits. There's a pregnant pause. And then the book is published in Italy. It becomes a huge success. It's then published in languages all across the world. I should say, with a little help from the CIA, who are aware that this is a sort of a Soviet sore point. And then Pasternak wins the Nobel Prize and the whole situation sort of explodes. And this ends very sadly for Boris Pasternak. He's hounded really quite aggressively in the press and by Khrushchev in particular. And there are all sorts of kind of accusations thrown at him. There are people turning up to his house where he lives and kind of throwing ink at the walls and so on. And there's talk of exiling Pasternak. They actually privately look into whether there might be criminal proceedings against him for sending this work abroad illegally. Nothing comes of that. And basically what happens is Pasternak, as sort of penance. Essentially, he's forced into this. He rejects the Nobel Prize, insisting that he's done so of his own free will, but nobody at all is convinced of this. His son eventually collects the Nobel Prize for him in the late 1980s. Pasternak is by that stage long dead.
Let's look at some of the era's demographic developments, because the 1960s broke new ground for women's rights in the West. But did women in the Soviet Union experience a similar upswing in rights and opportunities during this time?
Well, there are changes and there are important continuities as well. So I suppose a useful place to start here is that the Soviet regime comes to power talking about equality of men and women, talking about emancipating women. And it has a distinctly patchy record on this, to put it mildly. And the Stalin years in particular see lots of the kind of liberalisation and more progressive thinking about the place of women kind of being eroded during the Stalin years, especially during the late Stalin years, when there's this huge push essentially to turn women into baby machines to get the population up again after the tremendous losses of the Second World War. Khrushchev still wants, you know, he still fundamentally sees that one of the key duties of Soviet women is to have children and to, you know, to get the population up. But he's much more progressive in some ways than this sort of very blunt Stalinist approach. So we see, for example, under Stalin, abortion is criminalised, and under Khrushchev, it's legalised again in 1955. This isn't purely a sort of progressive thinking within him. Essentially, he thinks that what happens if you make abortion illegal is that people have backstreet abortions, and that does more damage in the long term in terms of fertility and so on. But generally, Khrushchev talks semi-frequently about equality between men and women, which, okay, talk is cheap, you might say, but equally, without any talk at all, the situation is worse. The actual progress is not that great, but generally speaking, you would look, for example, at the Communist Party, roughly 80% male, 20% female. But equally, you can look at, for example, rates of employment in the country. Female employment is going up all the time. This is partly because the regime needs more people working and the untapped resource is Soviet women. But of course, the women who go into work draw benefits from this in terms of, you know, independence and economic independence and so on. So by no means do we need to think of this just as a pragmatic or a propaganda measure on the part of the regime. There are some very important female figures throughout the period. So I don't suppose I said much about Valentina Tereshkova, for example, when we spoke about the space race. But she's a huge icon for men, and but especially for Soviet women and girls. And she helps to kind of inspire huge numbers of young women into studying the sciences, for example. More broadly, it's worth saying, roughly even amounts male-female in universities and so on, across the Soviet Union as a whole. But there are also kind of important areas where the rhetoric of equality has not really taken root at all in the Soviet Union. We see, for example, in Central Asia, certainly outside of the big cities, outside of Tashkent and so on, you get to the villages, they're still very, very kind of deeply traditional. There's really not much sort of consideration for this talk of equality of men and women in key places. Ordinary people sometimes are the problem as much as the regime itself.
It's interesting that you noted the perseverance of tradition there, because the 60s obviously have this iconoclastic reputation, with young people taking the lead in music, political protests, and the experimentation with substances. Was this also the case in the Soviet Union?
Well, this is one of the most interesting parallels with the 60s in the West in lots of senses. You know, young people are very prominent in the way that we understand this as an era, whether it's, you know, people screaming at the Beatles or whatever. And certainly young people are very prominent within the Soviet system in the West. Khrushchev is always kind of sort of geeing on young people to do more and celebrating their energy and so on and so forth. And this is an exciting time to be young in the Soviet Union, I think it's fair to say. One of the key things actually of interest that's worth mentioning is the World Youth Festival in 1957. It starts as a big propaganda exercise. Essentially, Khrushchev is trying to bring the outside world in to show them how great the Soviet Union really is. He feels that he can't kind of get around the lies of the international media. So the way that you show people how brilliant the Soviet Union is you bring them to the Soviet Union. And this ends in 1957 with about 30,000 foreign youth in Moscow, sort of at this International Festival of Youth and Students, all sort of hanging out and singing and dancing in the streets and so on. And it looks like, you know, there's really substantial change going on in the Soviet Union. Actually, it's something of a mirage that the world that exists in Moscow during the festival is not at all typical of the Soviet Union that exists before and after. So during the festival, there's abstract artwork on show in city parks. There's jazz bands playing in cafes and so on. And we see all sorts of parallels, again, with the West. So, for example, if we think about another of the big themes of the 60s in the West is sort of sexual revolution and this kind of thing. While it's probably overstating it to talk about the sexual revolution in the Soviet Union, not least because we just don't have, you know, a mass of evidence available on sort of intimate behaviours in that sense. But it's quite clear that there are important changes going on in the Soviet Union. So one of the very first Soviet sexologists, Igor Kon, starts to study sexual behaviour among sort of young adults, essentially, in the big cities at least. And it's worth emphasising here that the kind of attitudes and behaviours in the villages out in the middle of nowhere are always much more traditional. And we think this is kind of true across the developed world, but certainly in the big cities, whether that be Moscow or Leningrad or Kiev or wherever, they're changing rapidly, just as we're seeing in London and Paris and so on. So we start to see evidence, for example, the same basic patterns we're seeing in the West, that young people, they're having sex earlier than their parents did, that they're having more partners and so on and so forth, and they're more open to things like sex before marriage. These are, you know, basic patterns that we're observing in the West as well. Again, it's not exactly the same, but certainly it's a parallel that's worth drawing. In all this, though, I should also say that Soviet authorities are forever fretting about youth and young people. And again, this is something we see in the West as well. There's always worry about young people going off the rails and, you know, going bad, basically. If things get ugly internationally, can we really rely on this generation of young people with their rock and roll and so on? So authorities are constantly concerned that young people are coming off the tracks, let's say, in all sorts of ways, that they're getting into Western music, you know, the Beatles and the Stones. Before that, there's jazz and all this kind of stuff. So the Soviet authorities are always agitated about young people's behaviour. There's this sort of really interesting paradox that the young people in the Soviet Union are the best of the system. They're the most educated, but also they're its weakest point, that they're vulnerable to Western propaganda and so on. So there's this kind of continual tension about how young people behave. And there's always worries about things like hooliganism, great big clampdown on young people, whether drunkenness or anything else, of young people sort of running wild in Soviet streets. And there's a huge moral panic about the way in which hooliganism is spreading throughout the country, or else parasitism, the idea that people are becoming lazy and not working. And so, yeah, in much the same way that we see in the West, there's continual sort of frustration as well as celebration of young people.
And I suppose that contradiction found its ultimate culmination in the rise and brutal suppression of the Prague Spring in 1968. What does that event signify in the span of the Soviet 60s?
One of the key points I make in this book is that the major turning point in terms of the Soviet regime is not the ouster of Khrushchev in 1964. He's the key force behind lots of the liberalisation of the period. And so there is a natural tendency, with some justification, to see his removal in 1964 as the end of the period. I make the case, actually, that the end of the period comes with the crushing of the Prague Spring. And I suppose the key place to start here is that, firstly, the end of the Khrushchev period is not especially liberal in lots of very important ways. Khrushchev is becoming tougher and tougher in his sort of 62, 63, 64. He's becoming harder to deal with, and he's showing less inclination to liberalisation. And also, the early Brezhnev period, so the end of 64, 65, 66, there are suggestions that there's a new kind of thaw coming on the way. Pasternak is published again. Someone like Solzhenitsyn has kind of seen his career on hiatus, I suppose. He's published again, only a little. So it looks actually like the new incoming regime might be more progressive than we know it turns out to be. We know that the long 1970s is essentially characterized by a strong conservative tendency at the top of the Soviet regime, stronger than has been the case for a long time. But that's not totally clear at first, when, you know, in the mid-60s, once Brezhnev's in, there are clearly forces around him who are pushing for a stronger conservative turn, and sometimes also for a partial or even full rehabilitation of Stalin, which Brezhnev wisely sees as dangerous, or at least he's told it's dangerous, and he kind of comes to accept that advice as valid. So the Prague Spring is important partly because it sort of really defines this conservative turn, I suppose you would say. So it's coming anyway, I think it's fair to say, but certainly the worry in the Soviet leadership over what happens when you start to reform. So for anyone who's not come across the Prague Spring as an idea before, this is when the communist regime in Czechoslovakia, which is allied to the Soviet Union but not part of the Soviet Union, the regime in Czechoslovakia under Alexander Dubček decides that it's hit a kind of a dead end, and the way forward is through liberalisation, through kind of re-engaging people, young people especially, in the communist project. And that means more sort of open political discourse, more chance for participation, sort of exploring the problems of the past, of Stalinist repressions and so on, which also hit Czechoslovakia very badly. They're not trying to get rid of communism, they're trying to revive communism. And very quickly, the reforms in Czechoslovakia start to make the Soviet leadership nervous. And not just the Soviet leadership, but the other allied regimes of the region. So in East Germany, for example, and Poland and so on. Primarily because they're concerned that people will want this in our country too. So in Czechoslovakia, there's abolition of censorship. There's freedom to leave the country and come back in. There's much more open discussion on television and in the newspapers about the past and about problems like corruption and so on. And so you see the Soviet leadership increasingly alarmed that what the Czechoslovaks are doing, people will want in this country. And it will start to destabilize the situation inside the Soviet Union. And it's quite clear that on a low-ish level, this is actually happening. We see KGB reports about students in Ukraine, for example, west of Ukraine borders Czechoslovakia's useful context in that sense, that they're also talking about, well, we need to be like the Czechoslovaks. What they're doing is fantastic and bold, and we want that here. And sort of Soviet liberals especially are sort of agog, looking at what's going on in Czechoslovakia, hoping that this will be their country before too long. And that is absolutely not what Brezhnev and the increasingly conservative leadership of the Soviet regime are interested in at all. So ultimately what happens is that they invade Czechoslovakia to put a stop to the reformist regime there. Dubček is dragged to the Kremlin and browbeaten, and eventually goes back and undoes lots of these reforms. And for liberal-minded communists in the Soviet Union, this is really heartbreaking. This is sort of, you know, the end of the dream that there might be a more liberal version of the Soviet Union. Gorbachev famously in the 80s talks about the invasion of Czechoslovakia as a nail in the coffin of the Soviet regime. This is a crucial moment at which hope and vitality among a large section of the country, not everyone. There are lots of people who, you know, who sign up to all kinds of what you might consider very unpleasant ideas in the Soviet Union, as there are in every country. There are lots of people who cheer on the Soviet invasion, as, you know, Czechoslovakia is endangering the socialist bloc and so on. But there are also people for whom this is a kind of a breaking point with the regime, that, you know, our hopes of better in the Soviet Union have basically died with the invasion of Czechoslovakia. This is the end of the 60s hope and dream, as it were, of a more liberal, more enlightened Soviet regime.
That was Robert Hornsby, whose book, The Soviet 60s, is out now, published by Yale University Press. Thanks for listening to the History Extra podcast. This podcast was produced by Sam Leal Green.